As we have selected a rather unusual title and topic for this series of instructions, perhaps it will be wise to establish a certain background relating to the author whose works we are to examine. In the first place, General Albert Pike, whose life covered the greater part of the 19th century, was one of the outstanding men of his time. His career was so broadly diversified that he brought to almost any subject with which he was concerned not only a profound theoretical scholarship, but also a wide personal experience covering more activities than are crowded into the life of the average person. General Pike belonged to the same family as Zebulon Pike, the explorer. And he belonged to a period, an American background. And we find that his family reached America in the 17th century. And from that time on, had become an essential part of our tradition. General Pike himself presents a number of interesting, remarkable facets. Perhaps one of the most unusual is his struggle for an education. He was of a considerable family, and his father was of humble means. Therefore, from the beginning, it was necessary for Pike to find his own way. He early exhibited a remarkable scholarship, and by the time he reached college years, he passed successfully every examination necessary for his entrance into Harvard. He also was one of those young men who found it necessary to work his way to an education, and he prepared as best he could for what he regarded to be an essential form of training in the unfoldment of his own instincts and desires. Finally, having attained a sufficient amount of funds to pay for the first part of his scholastic year, he made the long and difficult journey to Harvard, some say on foot, in order to conserve what means he had. Arriving there, he was informed that his scholastic standing was satisfactory in every way, but that he could not enter the college unless he could pay for both terms, or 1 year's work. Being utterly unable to do so, he was forced to give up his hope, for at that time, apparently, there were no scholarships available as today. This was said to have been his first heartbreak, and it was not entirely compensated for when in his older years, Harvard offered him an honorary degree. At that time, he declined with thanks, saying that when he had come in need of an education, they could not provide it, and by the time they had so graciously offered it, he no longer stood in need of it. This particular point is one of many anecdotes, and as we go through the series, we will occasionally introduce some of these, but we do not wish to make the entire evening anecdotal, so that we will pass on to a few important points. Finding education on a formal level, more or less closed to him by his own poverty, Pike followed the general practice of young men of his time and went west. In the course of this journey, he went along through Missouri and finally came into New Mexico and stopped for some time at Taos. From there, he proceeded into the Indian country, establishing a trapping line, or servicing a group of traps in order to make a living. It was with his early contact with the Indians that he came to have certain understanding and appreciation for their values. These were to form an important part of his later career. After other vicissitudes, he finally settled in Arkansas, where he became known as a good Arkansas gentleman. In these days also, he supported himself by school teaching and gradually became a more or less influential member of the Arkansas Society of the time, if we wish to so designate it. He improved himself in law and finally became an outstanding lawyer, and the records of the period of his residence in Arkansas show that he was involved in nearly one-third of the litigations in the area. He was elected also to office and assisted in preparing the papers for the incorporation of the city of Little Rock. In these same years, he took an interest in newspaper editing, became the temporary manager of a newspaper and owner thereof, a procedure which has been noted as having resulted in a marked literary improvement in the journal. But apparently the journal also weighed rather too heavily upon him, and he finally relinquished most of his influence in journalism in order to continue his practice of law. Life moved on with him in this way until the Civil War, at which time he received the commission of Brigadier General in the Confederate Army, and it is from thence comes his title of General. He was given command over a large group of American Indian soldiers, and this was one of the most difficult positions which he was required to fill. At that time, the Confederacy was very much afraid that the Indians would become involved in the Civil War, and that therefore every effort should be made to regulate and direct their activities in a more or less orderly manner. General Pike was given this difficult matter to handle, and he later became also involved in the Great Cherokee Migration, which is one of the rather unpleasant episodes in American history, one of the most terrible experiences through which the Indian ever passed. Needless to say, Pike was on the side of the Indian. In this way, his life went on, and with it a continuous process of scholarship. His home was at one time surrounded by Union soldiers while he was in the army, not there, with the intent of burning it down. But when the commanding officer saw the library and other evidences of extraordinary scholarship in the house, he placed an honor guard around it and would not permit the house to be injured in any way. With all other Confederate officers of the time, he lost his citizenship, of course. But this was personally returned to him by President Johnson, and with it, he was relieved of most of the burden from which at that time Confederate officers were suffering. After this period in his life, we begin to see the rise of his new and perhaps one of his most dynamic interests. In 1857, Albert Pike was coroneted as an honorary 33rd degree Mason of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite of the Southern Jurisdiction. A year later, he became an active member, which was a participating member. This might sound as though the general had come up in the world quite a bit, but in the time when he received this degree, there were less than 1,000 Scottish Rite Masons in the United States. It has been said of him that he found Masonry in a log cabin and left it in a palace. Gradually, his interest in Masonry increased. Later, when he was raised to the honor of the Supreme Grand Commander or Sovereign Grand Commander of the Scottish Rite of the Southern Jurisdiction, he devoted his life almost completely to Masonic research. Gradually, his interest centered more and more in Washington, and the closing years of his life were spent there. The fact that he was raised to his highest Masonic honor exactly 100 years ago has caused Masonry throughout America and Europe to set aside a special celebration in honor of this circumstance. We may also point out that in the day of General Pike, Freemasonry, in particularly in its higher degrees, lacked most of the integration and sublimity with which modern Masonry has been enriched. Therefore, General Pike, in his great work, The Magnum Opus, which is not available to the public, rewrote completely the rituals of the Scottish Rite from the 4th to the 32nd degree, and also made very definite provisions for the 33rd and last degree. Into this work which he did, General Pike involved the total pattern of his scholarship. And these rites today are rich in philosophical values which would otherwise not be so apparent if present at all. In his scholarship, General Pike was more or less a pioneer in America, inasmuch as he extended his work into fields comparatively unexplored. He devoted a great deal of time to the mastery of the Hebrew language, and was able, therefore, to translate very large parts of the Zohar and the Talmud from the original. His manuscripts on these subjects and others are in the house of the temple. Another side of his scholarship is that he completely translated from the Latin the Roman law. This was an enormous undertaking and carried him into a very broad field of legal research. Further than this, he became a master of the Zen language and translated the great religious classics of the Persians, particularly the Zend-Avesta. He also went further than this in his attainment of a knowledge of Sanskrit, and was therefore able to also leave in manuscript and partly published forms his translations of the Vedas and the great classical works of India. For a man constantly laboring, not only under restricted means, but under a tremendous load of responsibilities, we can see that he accomplished a great deal. There is a story told of him that while he was in Washington, where he used to love to sit by his window and watch his canary birds in their cages, and smoke his very long pipe, which unfortunately some of his successors attempted to smoke with very serious results, news came that a very distinguished scholar from Europe, with certain abstract problems in philology, was searching for an educated American. Having visited nearly all of the universities, including the one that Pike did not get into, he was ready to leave and return to Europe because he had found no one whose knowledge was broad enough or deep enough to meet his needs. Therefore, at this time, someone suggested to him, "Have you ever gone down to Washington and talked to General Pike?" He said he never had gone there, he had never heard of General Pike, and who was he? But he was finally convinced that a brief detour would not do him any great amount of harm, so he went down for an afternoon and spent 6 months. During this time, as he afterwards expressed it, he had found the educated American. Pike's personal memory went back a long ways to the time when, as a young man, he had shaken hands with the Marquis de Lafayette. His entire life, running from about 1809 to about 1891, therefore covers a very large part of our American scene during this period. He is remembered, perhaps, as he was photographed for the great Civil War photographer Brady in Washington, as a very large man with a long black frock coat, white hair hanging in ringlets on his shoulders, and a full beard. He is said to have been exceedingly picturesque. On one occasion, while he was away on a trip, word was received by his friends in Washington that General Pike had met a sudden and unfortunate death. It was the wrong Pike, but no one knew it at the time. So a celebration, a kind of a wake, was held for him by his intellectual cohorts of various kinds. And just as the celebration was reaching its height, General Pike walked in the door. Unfortunately, the doorbell was answered by an underling of some kind who explained to him quickly the situation. Pike said, "Do not say anything. Just take me into the next room where I can sit and listen while nice things are being said about me." So he listened until he felt that he really had been duly honored, and then he made an appearance. This, he said, was to his mind perfectly correct, and the anecdote is preserved under the title of The Wake of a Good Arkansas Gentleman. Pike's sense of humor in masonry, as well as his scholarship, has never been forgotten. There is an old legend which probably is more true than otherwise, that when the time used to come for him to confer the 33rd degree upon some likely and proper candidate, he would get into a dashboard buggy with the candidate sitting on the back with his feet hanging over the back of the wagon. They would then take enough supplies for a very pleasant and convivial time and ride out to a quiet spot along the Potomac. Pike would sit on one end of a log and the candidate on the other. And when the refreshments had been finished, the candidate had been duly raised. Pike's attitudes on all things were not only profound, but delightfully human. He had none of the heaviness of scholarship. He was a genial, pleasant, capable person. And one of the last things relating to him, perhaps, of interest, is on his deathbed, in the last few days of his life, the general was unable to speak. But shortly before his death, his friends noted that he moved his hand very quietly and very feebly to the wall alongside of his bed, and there he traced on the wall the Hebrew letter Shin. It was one of the last things that he ever did. By this character, he implied the word Shiloh, which means peace. And that was probably the last known important action which he performed. The general's attainments, therefore, divide into several groups. And in 1957, the Supreme Council, through its librarian, has prepared an outline of the works, writings, manuscripts, and papers of General Albert Pike. And through the courtesy of the House of the Temple, we have a copy of this. And we might note that although about a dozen pages, or maybe 20, are devoted to various anecdotes and other material, the rest of the book is nothing but a classified listing of his work, running into hundreds of volumes. So that he presents an interesting situation. Now, this in itself might justify his inclusion in a discussion, of course, such as we contemplate. But I think there are two other points that are very interesting and important. General Pike's scholarship was, during his own time, widely recognized. He was a man whose attainments in the fields of philosophy, comparative religion, and related subjects were outstanding, perhaps almost unique, possibly the only contemporary rival that he may have had was Professor Max Müller, the great German Orientalist. As a result of this unusual attainment, it has long seemed that his writings, while in many instances related particularly to the subjects of Freemasonry with which he was most concerned, his writings extend far beyond this field, far beyond what might be termed such material as is of exclusive Masonic interest. It enters into almost every department of knowledge. Therefore, it seems appropriate that he and his work should be remembered in the field of general philosophy, in the field of comparative religion, and in all other fields in which his remarkable achievements have lasting value. It is a pity that works which are basic, which represent the highest levels of personal scholarship, should be neglected merely because they have been associated with a fraternity. The works stand completely on their own, and as such, we wish to discuss them and to a measure the philosophical attitudes and principles which General Pike not only believed and taught, but exemplified in his own conduct. So with these preambling remarks, perhaps we can go to the subject of the evening, which cuts across both Masonic and non-Masonic fields, because it certainly belongs very closely to the study of comparative religion, and as such, to the interests that we all have. Among the lesser-known writings of General Pike, in addition to his principal text, Morals and Dogma, are his lectures on Masonic symbolism, which are limited in addition to 100 copies of each work. And one of these lectures, or one of these works, is devoted to the analysis of the Omkara, or the sacred name. And as it is touched upon also in Morals and Dogma, and also in another work of Pike's, the Sefer HaDibron, it seems that it might be an interesting point with which to open our general consideration of his philosophy. Naturally, Pike was convinced, as most students today are, that there were in antiquity, not only in the Western nations, but also in the Eastern nations, schools of esoteric philosophy, schools which prescribed certain profound and particular disciplines for the cultivation of man's internal life. These schools were the mysteries, and they were cherished and respected and honored in India, China, Greece, Egypt, and even into the Roman Empire. These schools, taught by a series of symbolic processes, causing the individual to grow or unfold by a process of intuiting from emblems, symbols, allegories, fables, and parables. In the beginning, therefore, General Pike wants to point out that the language of the mysteries was never a literal tongue. Not because perhaps men wished to conceal, but because those things which men most desire to know cannot be communicated with words. Man cannot merely be told a truth greater than his own capacity to understand. Therefore, the only way in which that can be imparted, for which there is not already an available content of understanding, is by means of symbols. Symbols are important because they cause the individual to increase his own understanding by the contemplation of them. They cause him to draw out from himself a background or a subconscious power to know, which he has not as yet advanced in a factual or objective manner. Therefore, symbols teach by persuasion. They introduce, they excite, they stimulate, they challenge. They are like the child's riddle. They cause the individual to desperately, in one way or another, seek to understand them. He feels himself frustrated by his own ignorance. He cannot allow this condition to continue. So instead of merely seeing and forgetting, he sees and examines. By examination, his attention is focused. By this attention, his concentration is stimulated. By concentration, in turn, his insight is strengthened, and he begins to search in himself for any shreds, any fragments, any parts of things previously known which can have a bearing upon this new mystery. And first of all, he discovers that there is more knowledge in himself than he has suspected. He discovers that by uniting all his resources, he can grope forward toward a more adequate explanation of the thing which he seeks to know. This is good Orientalism in basic principle. It is the problem that lies behind the vast image pageantry of Asia. If the person is without imagination, if he is without desire for insight, if he is not in any way stimulated beyond the obvious, then the symbol remains a locked and literal mystery. But as he says, General Pike says in his work, the great heritage of Masonry, and in this he refers also by a broader meaning to any symbol that has descended within a body of philosophy or religion, that the great heritage lies in these emblems, in these figures, which meant something, which inspired and guided, and which were left as landmarks for those who came after, inviting the individual not merely to listen, but to search, but to quest in himself for the meanings locked within the symbols. A good symbol, therefore, a great symbol, is not immediately exhaustible. In fact, it may not be even remotely exhaustible. It is something that continues to mean more as we become capable of understanding more. Therefore, we can go back over the book of symbols, and each time we read it or look through it or scan it, we bring to bear upon it the latest acquirements of our own consciousness. So the symbol is forever unfolding like a flower, not because it changes in its own nature, but because our nature's changing are reflected upon the surface of the device or emblem. This type of thinking, to a great degree, explained General Pike's revision of the rites of the Scottish degrees. He enriched their symbolism, fully aware that this symbolism had a certain censorship over itself. There would be some who would see. There would be others who would not see. There would be some who would accept one interpretation, suitable to their immediate need. Others would accept another interpretation because of greater insight of their own. But man, by the very nature of him, can never totally outgrow the symbol because it continues to unfold as he grows, actually almost to infinity. He is always finding more in the symbol because there is more in himself. This is a key, perhaps, to a great many things. It seems to me, for example, that it is a very good key to Holy Scriptures, for we know how frequently and wonderfully these works are quoted. Each person will quote them to support his own immediate interpretation, but as he changes, the interpretations change. And in the United States alone, the Christian Bible is subject to more than 500 principal interpretations, each derived from the same text, but each revealing a different degree of insight, a different degree of personal reaction to idea and to the content behind parables, allegories, and phrases. Thus it is that the symbolical or emblematic form of instruction, based to a degree upon the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphical method, constitutes the kind of education that the word education itself implies from educo, meaning to draw forth or to bring out of the individual that which is in himself. This is one of the basic principles upon which Pike developed his entire wealth of symbolism, deriving it from innumerable ancient sources, bringing it together into magnificent dramatic patterns, weaving these elements into a rich tapestry for the contemplation of those so minded. Also, as those of us realize who have worked even with tapestries as such, there can be a long association with a great product of the Gobelin tapestry factories. And each time we look at the magnificent work, we see something new. And this ability to forever see something new takes us away from the prosaic, and once more, and particularly, it takes us away from the dogmatic. A symbol is not a dogma. A symbol does not say to you, thus you shall believe, or that you shall deny. A symbol does not force upon you an incomprehensible meaning, nor does it bind you to a decadent one. It is constantly new. It constantly binds you only to your immediate apperceptive power. The symbol means what it means to you now, regardless of what it meant to the ancients or may mean to the unborn future. Thus this becomes a tremendous method, a tremendous scientific procedure for the enrichment of man and the increase of his knowledge. Now, among the symbols that have had particular interest to us for a very long time has been that which deals with the sacred name of deity. And this particular symbolism, as Pike observes, is almost universally diffused. Among the most primitive peoples, there are certain taboos and restrictions upon the pronouncing of the name of God. These restrictions are to be frequently found in the early Jewish metaphysics relating to the Old Testament, where the name of deity was not permitted to be used, and wherever it occurred in the sacred scriptures, another word or another name, Adonai, was given in order that the sacred name might not be spoken. even when the Masoretic points were added, these points were the ones taken from another word, so that still the original pronunciation of the divine name was concealed. The Egyptian myth or legend of Ishtar commanding Re, the sun deity, to reveal his secret name is another example of the same. In Africa, each native is given a secret name, and any person who is able to possess that name possesses the soul of the man. These legends go very far back. We find them among the American Indians, and we find them also in India and in China and in Japan. And the concept not only extends to Hinduism and Persian philosophy, but also descends into Buddhism and continues down to our present time. In the book of Revelation, for example, it is stated that the person who overcomes or is successful under the trials will be given a new name or a secret name written upon the broken halves of a stone, a white stone. The parts of the stone are then rejoined and bound together so that no one may know the name except the one to whom it is given. In the early Egyptian rite, for example, in the cultural history of Egypt, each Egyptian was given two names. One was his milk name, which was given to him at birth, his child name. When he reached maturity, he was given a temple name, a name which was said to have been calculated for him by the priests to exemplify particularly his own deepest and most valuable attributes or qualities. It is common, of course, also that the giving up or the casting away of a name has an important meaning. In the ancient times, for instance, the idea of name had to do with a kind of identity. The individual and his name, more or less, were in sympathetic spiritual relationship to each other. The name, therefore, was the person. The person, in turn, was the name. If, therefore, an individual decided to change his way of life, he might very well change his name. And this was especially true in connection with the monastic orders of Europe, wherever a person entered priesthood or became a monk or a nun, they took a different name. They gave up their earth name. They gave up their mortal name and usually took the name of a saint or some sanctified person. By this was the final, we shall say, renunciation of self. To give up the name was to give up self, to give up identity, to cease all egoism or to cease all emphasis upon selfness or the importance of an individual or personal career or outlook toward life. These practices, widely diffused and continuing among many peoples even to the present time, undoubtedly originated in a very ancient system of culture. In the New Testament, we are told that there is a peculiar malediction, a peculiar curse to be raised against any person who shall change a name or a word of the text. That even in this sense, translation is a violation of this original concept. Now, some will assume, for instance, that this means only a great piety or orthodoxy or perhaps some magical overtone. But such apparently was not the original intention. The concept seems to be the same as that expounded by Pythagoras of Samos. In other words, the name becomes a curious key to the thing named. By this I mean that nearly every name indicates the principle, the situation, the condition, the factor which the word itself has been applied to. Thus, for example, in the Old Testament, the name of Moses is something which contains within it a Kabbalah, a secret meaning. And those possessing the knowledge of the art may take from the name the true meaning of the thing represented by the symbol. Thus, the true identity of this person, whom we know was not actually named Moses, but to whom this name was given, the identity is concealed in the name. The same was true of Pythagoras himself. He pointed out that his own name, Pythagoras, was the master key to his entire system of instruction. If, therefore, this name was taken out of its original language so that it could no longer be analyzed by the mathematical philosophy involved in that language with the correspondences between numbers and letters, between mathematical formulas and the shapes and structures of letters, if these were changed, then the key to meaning was lost. For that reason, it was always held that the name was most important, that the name was the immediate landmark by means of which a mystery concealed beneath a name could be quickly discerned, and the entire statement or the symbolic pattern involved with the name could be reorganized, changed, and directed into the full statement of its true meaning. This situation we find frequently in classical literature, where the names of the Greek gods, the names of the Egyptian deities, the names of the Hindu deities, the names of the Chinese divinities, all these are not merely personal names. They are philosophical formulas by means of which a new dimension of understanding is possible. And in each one of the countries involved, including China, India, and Arabia, there are definite arts or sciences by means of which these names can be opened. There is a key to them, the key which turns seven times in the lock, the key which, twisting back and forth in an involved combination formula, results, for example, in the unfoldment perhaps of an entire text out of one name. This type of thinking is unfamiliar to us, and we probably have more or less neglected to develop it. At the same time, we know the ancient did, and the principles of it are preserved in the Kabbalah under the Notoricon and Gematria, the ways of breaking open names or words, and through the study of them to correct errors which might otherwise creep into our thinking and our philosophy. General Pike points out that deities of various levels nearly always have peculiar word combinations involving certain specific and definite numbers of letters. The great Jesuit priest scholar Athanasius Kircher developed what he called his design of the 72 names of deity. These 72 names are all composed of four letters and represent an almost universal diversity of roots. That the number four, therefore, had a particular and peculiar significance in relationship to certain deities, we have to remember. We must also remember that the number three is also carefully and definitely associated with another order of divinities, and the number seven with and still a different order. We also realize that Irenaeus, in his discussion of the Gnostics, points out this mysterious being, a creature devised symbolically, a kind of diagrammatic person, upon whose body the letters of the alphabet were completely distributed throughout the body. Pythagoras tells us, for example, that in the pronunciation of the word Pythagoras, it is necessary for the mind to energize a series of levels of sound, that these sounds in turn have forms, that these forms in turn are the bases of ideas, and that in the mere pronunciation of these names, such as the name of Pythagoras, a tremendous vibratory circumstance occurs within the constitution of the individual. In the Gnostic symbolism, we have the seven-rayed lion deity, the lion-headed Mithras. In the round, the head of this deity, are placed the seven vowels, and the name of the deity is composed of these vowels. Now we also find, in relation to the same Gnostic mystery, in the concept of the Christos, we find the statement, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. When in the case of the Gnosis, the central letter is added, then we find in the Gnostics their form of the ineffable name, consisting of the vowels A, I, and O. Now this A-I-O combination, reversed, rearranged, inverted, returns in a great many ancient languages because it represents certain primary sounds. These sounds, in turn, having to do with the essential nature of deity. In the East Indian philosophy, we have a word that is generally translated transliterated into the letters O-M. This word, however, in the original actually consists of three letters, although in the sounding and arranging of them, this has been more or less neglected. More correctly, perhaps, if we wanted to transliterate, we would come upon A-O-M or A-U-M because of the structure of language. Now, as you also know, in the ancient languages, U and V were interchangeable. And even in early English, this is true. Even as late as the Elizabethan period, the U and V form and the W were interchangeable. So A-U-M, A-O-M, or A-V-M stand together to represent something. The principle for which the symbol stands is that of the Supreme Being. Yet the Supreme Being is not merely indicated by what has been termed a monosyllable, but what is really 2 1/2 syllables. It's a very peculiar structural form. But now when the Hindu approaches this subject, he tells us, for example, that these three letters become the first letters of three words. That A stands for Agni, the principle of fire. That the U, V, or O, for which are interchangeable, stands for Varuna, which is the principle of water. And the M stands for the Mahuts, or the principle of air. Therefore, we have these three letters standing for three elements, fire, water, and air. Now, for instance, in your Hermetic rites, fire is calculated or held under the name Herm, which means flame. Therefore, your deity or your great teacher, Hermes, represents the principle of fire. Now, in the same concept, for instance, we have another symbol which has occurred in your alchemical situation. And that is the deity or goddess Aphroditus or Aphrodite, the principle of water. If, therefore, in the alchemical process you marry fire, which is Hermes, to Aphrodite, which is water, or you achieve the marriage of the sun and moon, you produce what is called in alchemy the hermaphrodite, the Hermes Aphroditus, which means the fire, water, the male, female, God, nature, heaven, earth. And the words themselves become of great importance to us. Now, in the ancient legend of the building of Solomon's temple, we find in the Bible that a very cunning workman by the name of Hiram was brought to assist in the development of the temple ornamentations and artifacts. Now here is one of the interesting examples of what happens when we make a mistake. In the ancient language, the Hebrew letter H and CH are almost identical. The only difference is that in the CH, a stroke is slightly separated from another stroke, which is, in the H the stroke is separated, and in the CH it is not. The figures are identically the same in general appearance. Therefore, the term Hiram has come out of a CHRI instead of an HIR. Thus, we have Huram, Hiram, instead of Hiram. Now, when we take it in this form, we have CH, R, and M. We have the three letters of the language. We have the Chet, the Resh, and the Mem, which mean fire, air, and water. And we are exactly back to our A-U-M in India. Therefore, we must search for something which justifies this. We must seek, if we can, to find out why this CH, or the fire symbol, was used in connection with this person. We know that he was a cunning workman in metals, and we also know that fire is the only element that will work metals, so that it has to be fire. But this is the hermetic fire, the fire of the mysteries, the fire of transmutation, the fire of regeneration, the fire which tempers steel, the fire which takes base metals and fuses them, permitting them to be worked. And under this fire, we therefore have an appropriate symbol of the creating power. And the great religions of antiquity, of course, included in ancient times the worship of fire, the worship of the principle of life as fire. In the East Indian system, therefore, our sacred name contains the roots of the three powers, the three basic qualities by means of which earth is moved. We may say, therefore, that fire represents spiritual content, that water represents psychical content, and air represents intellectual content. We come, therefore, further into the idea of a triad composed of spirit, soul, and mind. We further find that the fourth element is always left out, the element of earth. Therefore, we have a quaternary consisting of three agents operating upon a fourth power or principle. Thus, by such analysis, we can begin to apply the meaning of certain words, using them as methods for the discovery of valid principles concealed beneath words. Why in the ancient rituals and symbolism should the name of deity be regarded with such peculiar veneration, and to be regarded also as something that must not be revealed? In ancient times, and in the Mithraic rites of the Persians, the name was also used in connection with the altar as a symbol of the veil. The name was the link between the deity, or the being defined, and the one defining. Thus man, approaching deity, approaches first the name of deity. This is the sacred name composed of flames that was said to have covered the face of the Ancient of Ancients in the old Kabbalistic legends. Those seeking to penetrate the mystery of God were first of all faced by what were called the army of the name, which is a very interesting thing. It returns to us again in Egypt, the army of the name. This army formed the god of honor. It protected the substance or the subject of the thing named from profanation. You could not escape from the facing of the name. Wherever you turned, you were confronted not with the thing itself, but with its likeness or appearance. Therefore, Paracelsus also tells us that nature is a divine writing, and that every form that we see around us is a kind of symbolic alphabet, or element of a symbolic alphabet. That all things together spell out things, and that this spelling out forms words, forms patterns, and makes available ideas. Actually, however,
name now in the Hindu philosophy becomes a very important thing in itself. Actually, in the Hindu system, and also in the Persian Avestan system, in which the hum, H-U-M, appears as a prominent factor, the name becomes both the cognizable and the knowable aspect of something in itself unknowable. We may speak the name without knowing the nature. Therefore, name and nature are not, in philosophical mysteries, entirely identical. We may remember the words of Van Dyck, "Who names it shall never find it, and for the one who finds it, it needs no name." Thus, name becomes, in a sense, a veil. It is the army of letters that conceals the truth. And the individual who is content to accept the name will never possess the fact. Socrates gives us this same priceless bit of information in another way, in which he discourses with his disciples concerning the difference between name and nature. He asks a disciple what a certain thing is. And for example, we will say that disciple says, "Master, this is a carrot." So the master said, "Fine, that is what it is. Now what is a carrot?" "Well, a carrot, master, is a vegetable." "Well, if it's a vegetable, what kind of a vegetable is this?" And the disciple says, "Master, this is a carrot." And by that time, Socrates smilingly says, "Yes, and now my ignorance is complete." Yet how many of us have been accustomed to name substitution for idea? There is scarcely an idea that we possess that hasn't died in the naming. There is practically no principle which we seek in which our desire to discover is not satisfied merely by name. Instead of searching for idea content, we call things by names that have been given to them. True, if we are to believe Genesis, these things were named according to their natures. But their natures are concealed in the names, only by gematria. To discover the meaning, we must penetrate the veil, or the name. Therefore, in the mysteries, the name was emblazoned upon the gate of the sanctuary. But it was so emblazoned as to be undecipherable, concealed in some symbolic form that might not easily be captured or known. It identified the house of the God, but it did not reveal the God. In the same way, nature, as the great name, identifies the house of cause, or the house of principle, but it does not reveal the principle. It shows us a series of symbolic depictions of principle. But as long as we are willing to accept the shadow for the substance, the name for the thing named, we are in a desperate situation of ignorance. Here is where modern semantics is stepping in an effort to relieve us from the burden of name. We name a person, and yet in naming them, we accept them without knowing them. Yet we regard the fact that we possess their name as important. We know or believe that if we can call a person by his right name, he is a friend. If we call him by his first name, he is an intimate friend or a relative. But called by any name, he remains unknown. For actually, the name is never, as far as our thinking is concerned, enough to provide us with the substance for which that name stands. The name, therefore, is applied to a being, a condition, a situation, or a fact. Yet by this, we have only the stimulation of a general identificational orientation. We do not have the substance. This, furthermore, points out the danger of the total substitution of the spoken word for idea. It reminds us that the essential facts we desire can never be communicated by word alone, and also reminds us, as the Greek pointed out, that we have come into the sovereign difficulty of all. We now have come to think with words. This is a very important thing. When an idea comes to us today, even out of ourselves, this idea, before it is even concreted, is expressed in our own consciousness by a name. We give it a name before we have even formulated it. We think with words. And because words have sunk into us from a great many association factors, they have become like tiny blocks with which we attempt to build up ideas. Therefore, we array a word against a word and believe that we are toying with ideas, which we are not. We have never permitted ideas to have the freedom from the word.